Now, so we're proceeding into Q&A. Well, really, Robert, you've answered this question. Do you think reporters or editors are responsible for one-sided reporting about the Ukrainian situation?
Well, obviously, yes, I do. I think what we've seen, and I must say, in my 37 years covering Washington, I have never seen anything quite like this. I have seen groupthinks. I have seen conventional wisdom. I have seen people in Washington go off completely half-cocked in the wrong direction. I have never seen something almost totalitarian like this, where there is an across the board, from essentially right to left and center, a way of presenting this story to the American people, which I'm not saying it's entirely wrong, but it is certainly highly one-sided, and it has not given the American people the kind of balance that they need to understand this very serious crisis. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I didn't understand that part of it. The way it works, and I've been in these situations. Rarely do you get the strict orders to do a story a certain way, but you certainly know which way your editor or your publisher wants to go with it, and you know that if you go against that grain, you do so at your own career risk. And even if you do your job very, very well, maybe if you do it very, very well, it makes you even more vulnerable. You become a target, and you become a target of not just your competitors in the business, but also your editors might not want to back you, your publisher, your bureau chief, whoever's in charge of you will make it clear that you're not wanted, that you're not someone that they think they want to have as part of your group, their organization. And so it's a mix of things. Yeah, and at the level I was at as a correspondent, reporter, you often don't get it as directly as I'm sure my superiors got it from people in charge. But I would say, there was this great myth about the liberal media that existed throughout much of my time in Washington, and there's no really such thing as a liberal media. It was basically, it was run by people who tended to be fairly conservative, or at least, very much pro-establishment, let's say. And so those people would pass on what they wanted. When I was at the Associated Press, the guy running AP was named Keith Fuller. He was very conservative. He was a big supporter of Ronald Reagan. He gave speeches even about how Reagan's victory in 1980 was a major turning point for America, and how it was a time, as he put it, he went through a whole series of terrible things that had been happening in America, and he said, "We don't want to have the union of we want the union of Adam and Eve, not the union of Adam and Bruce." Was one of the things he was upset about at the time. So that sort of reflects the kind of thinking that you often found from the higher ups. And when I went to Newsweek, it was even worse. Newsweek was very much pro-State Department. They made it very hard on their correspondents who were in the field reporting back honestly about things. They often fired them or removed them, sent in people who would report things the way the embassies wanted in the field. So that's how it came down.
I'd like to add something about the media here. Part of the problem here with the Ukrainian story, I think, is that the media, we have, the framing is different, not just the specific issues, but I don't think we understand the deeper framing of the questions between the West and Russia. And this has developed over a long period of time. There's some very different cultural and value questions that are going on there that are not just specifically Ukraine, which is just the latest manifestation of it. The other thing I wanted to say is that there are a lot of media opportunities which are languishing for lack of pursuit. So in the regional papers, for example, there are fantastic career niches. There are Pulitzer Prizes waiting for people who will pursue issues assiduously, often with nonprofit help, who do FOIAs, who do real investigative work, and that can make an enormous difference. One of the themes that could have been said about the weapons laboratories and the weapons complex is that there is a tension between visibility and invisibility. A lot of things happen no one knows about, but they're there in plain sight. 8 people were contaminated at Los Alamos Lab in December. With plutonium-238, it's never been in the newspaper.
Our
Plutonium-238 is much more toxic than plutonium-239, and 1 microgram of plutonium-239 is definitely carcinogenic if you inhale it or get it into your body. 238 is much more dangerous, by 100 times?
Almost 300 times.
300 times more dangerous. And that's what they want to put in the satellites, to power the satellites. They already are.
But the fact that the local paper did cover the kitty litter issue brought that into visibility and for the first time tore away every bit of the corporate profit that had been designated for Los Alamos Laboratory and took 2 years of their contract away. And now Bechtel is reportedly considering whether they even want to be involved.
Well, I mean, there's another example I'd like to draw your attention to, which is out at the Hanford site in Washington State. Hanford was one of the main producers of plutonium for nuclear weapons going back to World War II. Fantastically contaminated site with an enormous amount of radioactive waste. Literally hundreds of workers were requiring medical attention from exposure to hazardous vapors emanating from these waste tanks, going on for years. And despite efforts by the public interest community to sort of bring this to the attention, when I worked as a congressional investigator in the Senate in the late 80s, I mean, we were pounding on these guys about it. And the bureaucracy was impervious to this. Finally, in the last 2 or 3 years, an intrepid reporter with the local TV Channel 4 station in Seattle, Kona, just was relentless and was doing carpet bombing on these guys and putting sick workers in front of the camera, having them tell their stories, how they were sort of just discarded and forgotten and retaliated against. Eventually, this has now led to the unprecedented step by the state of Washington, the Attorney General, who is now filing a lawsuit for knowing endangerment at the Hanford site. It's just totally unprecedented for this to happen.
Okay, the next question is for Bob Alvarez. I maintain that Atoms for Peace was the stupidest ideas Eisenhower ever had. Does Alvarez agree or disagree?
Well, I think that if you pull the string and look at the history of this, it was originally conceived as a public relations stunt that got legs because of the bureaucratic momentum and the irresistible smell of money that was coming out of this from the Atomic Energy Commission. And it took on a life of itself. And it really didn't become much of anything when you think about this until around the late 1960s. I mean, in the 1960s, the United States, Russia, or Soviet Union to a large extent, they were really sprinkling a lot of so-called nuclear goodies around the world, especially highly enriched uranium for research reactors. And there was a major push to commercialize nuclear power at this time. And in the United States, one of the pieces of untold history is that by the mid-1960s, the United States had produced so much fissile materials for weapons, it just didn't need to do it anymore, other than a certain amount every year. And this caused a tremendous crisis within the bureaucracies of the Atomic Energy Commission. You have to understand these Department of Energy sites, or AEC sites, dominate the wage and benefit structures of large geographic areas that have employed people for generations. And they just took that bit in the mouth and sort of pushed the peaceful atom. It was no coincidence that General Electric, which ran the Hanford site in the 1960s, was leading the charge for commercial nuclear power. There was a really big bandwagon effect that sort of took on a dimension of leadership by the Atomic Energy Commission and a certain amount of tremendous hubris, whereby, as I pointed out, that people like Glenn Seaborg were envisioning, you know, just doing their calculations as physicists on pieces of paper, assuming, you know, demand would be this and that, that there would be this enormous growth of nuclear power without regard for the reality of it. And I think that quite frankly, you know, if you look objectively at what the Atoms for Peace program gave us, it gave us more and more nuclear weapons states.
Yeah, and there was a psychologist in the Pentagon at the time, 1956, who said, and his quote is in one of my books, that if people could accept the peaceful atom, they would not be so worried about nuclear weapons. In other words, it was a Trojan horse for the nuclear weapons industry. Okay, leading members of the financial oligarchy have advocated population reduction to what they call sustainable level of 1 to 2 billion people. There are now powerful circles pursuing a strategy for limited nuclear war, targeting Eurasia, especially Russia and China, and leaving the US and parts of Western Europe intact. Do you see these two policies as connected? How can we work with China and Russia to prevent this? How can we defuse the Ukrainian trigger for war? That's, yeah, Seth? Yeah.
Sure. So first, I have not heard anything at all about a plan for a nuclear war as a means of population reduction. I can't deny that it exists, or I mean, I can't confirm that it doesn't exist, I should say. I mean, what do I know? But this is certainly never something that I've heard any serious discussion of in any of the various policy and research corners that I look at. When we talk about overpopulation, it's an important thing to be clear about with this idea of overpopulation, because people itself isn't the problem. I mean, we shouldn't be upset because there are too many people. People are nice. We are people, right? The problem is not overpopulation per se. The problem is shortages of resources and things like that. And so when we think about overpopulation, what we should really be thinking about is resource scarcities and all the problems that can come from that. But resource scarcities are driven very differently by some people than by others. Most of us living here in New York City or the United States or Australia or other wealthier countries are causing a lot more of the resource depletion than people in, say, Southeastern Asia or Africa or Latin America who are less wealthy using less resources. So when we talk about overpopulation, especially if we start throwing out ideas like, oh, let's get rid of a bunch of people in, say, Southeastern Asia, which is, you know, a major locus of population, that doesn't really solve the core problems that we're talking about. Instead, what we should focus on is finding ways to have the people that we have live good lives without having to get rid of people. And that seems to me entirely feasible.
Population management. Educate the women and give them birth control.
I think that sometimes, I never heard anything like this before. However, there is something there. And in my talk, I called it the politics of disposability. And that's a very real phenomenon, domestically and internationally. Pepe Escobar is not the only one who talks about the empire of chaos, the United States. The neoconservative plan B for every failed plan A is to cause greater chaos. War serves many interests. War is the health of the state, some say. Some of us, who said that? I don't think we should be naive about this. They feel in Russia, there's a lot of people who feel in Russia that the United States wants to foment discontent and chaos all along the Russian borders. And I agree with that, because I believe that there is, in fact, a very serious resource crisis which has already developed and which some people know about. The Department of Energy might as well be the Department of Propaganda about energy. We do not understand this in the United States. We project a very false picture about this to Europe, to ourselves, and base a foreign policy on it. And yes, I think that empire of chaos, which means a lot of suffering, is very much part of some people's idea. And it's up to us to keep those factions in check and push their power down in this country, because they will continue to grow and gain power, and they are right now dominant.
Okay, I think this is for Robert Parry. Does the placement of former military branch intel officers into media management account for some of the Pentagon lockstep media?
Well, if you go back historically, and I've spent a lot of time at the Reagan Library, what you see is that when the Reagan administration came in 1981, they recognized that their biggest problem in terms of dealing with the world was what they called the Vietnam Syndrome. And the Vietnam Syndrome was that the American people had gotten fed up with being taken into wars that were ill-conceived, that were sold to them on false pretenses. They didn't trust the government. They didn't want to go back into something like that again. And the Reagan people recognized that that was a huge obstacle to what they wanted to do in the world. So, I think I mentioned briefly, they literally took the top propaganda figure, the top-ranking person in the Central Intelligence Agency, Walter Raymond Jr., and they moved him over to the National Security Council staff. And with William Casey, the director of CIA's oversight, they targeted the American people with propaganda. And they had interagency task force that handled it. One of their major bases was at the State Department, the so-called Public Diplomacy Office for Central America. That's where I dealt with them a great deal at that time. And these people were, a lot of them were, this was staffed with neocons. This is where some of the neocons sort of cut their teeth in coming to age in Washington. One of the guys I dealt with extensively at this office was Robert Kagan. Robert Kagan is a leading neoconservative. He's still very influential. He was one of the two co-founders of the Project for the New American Century in 1998, advocating the invasion of Iraq. He happens also to be the husband of Victoria Nuland, who is the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, who was one of the key figures in the coup that occurred a year ago in Ukraine. So they basically cut their teeth on this idea of manipulating the American people, and that became a central element of everything they do, and they're very good at it. They're very articulate. They write well. They're smart people, and they are now throughout not just the government bureaucracy, not just the Defense Department or the State Department or other agencies of the government. They permeate the media. They are in the Washington Post op-ed pages. They fill the think tanks. There was, like earlier, one of the speakers was talking about how the think tanks operate. They're basically funded by much of the military-industrial complex. And the military-industrial complex has an interest in promoting ideas that lead to more conflict. Duh. You know, it's sort of the obvious. So the neoconservatives have this regular trough of money. They also have the National Endowment for Democracy, which was set up in 1983. And in 1983, the idea was how do you do CIA-type interference around the world without it being tainted as CIA? And what they came up with was the National Endowment for Democracy, which was run then and is run today by a neoconservative named Carl Gershman. Carl Gershman, in September of 2013, before the crisis in Ukraine really began, he wrote a piece in the Washington Post where he said Ukraine is, quote, the biggest prize, and he saw it as a way to ultimately get Putin removed from leadership in Russia. So these ideas were already in play in the neoconservative community much earlier. And I think the other interesting thing here, going back to this point that Greg made about the empire of chaos, the neoconservatives, I think they have ideas that in their think tanks sound good. Like, okay, we'll invade Iraq, we'll get rid of Saddam Hussein, we'll put in Chalabi, we'll have everything will work fine. And the real world then confronts them, and that doesn't turn out as well, and it becomes chaos. But instead of learning, they just move to the next level. And the ultimate level, I sort of compare it to the children's ditty about the little old lady who swallowed the fly, and then she swallows the spider to catch the fly, and eventually she ends up swallowing a horse, and she's dead, of course. But So now the neocons have moved this, escalating this up through Iraq, through Syria, through, now they want to have war with Iran. They have all these ideas, and of course Putin has been in their way. He was helping the Syrians, helping the Iranians. He helped Obama avoid a war in Syria back in August of 2013, if you remember, after the sarin attack. It was Putin who came in and said, "We'll get Assad to give up his chemical weapons." So Putin has been a problem, and so they keep escalating. And now they're up to this. And they are actually thinking about, this is real, they are thinking about, as Gershman referenced, how do you destabilize the government in Moscow? And this is a brilliant idea. We have to get rid of Putin. How do you stop Putin? This is the stuff all these things are about.
That's right.
So, but now you're at this point. Okay, you destabilize Moscow. You destabilize Baghdad. That worked out really well. What if you destabilize Moscow? It doesn't mean that you're going to have some wonderful, you know, mild-mannered guy taking over after Putin has been hanged at the village square. You could end up with an extreme nationalist. I mean, this is just as likely as you are to get some nice guy, someone much worse than Putin, you know, not nearly as rational as Putin. So you could end up then, and this gets back to this whole nuclear issue. If you do that, if you destabilize Russia, you could end up with a very realistic situation where some very dangerous person gets control of the nuclear codes of Russia. And then where are you? Now, the neocons would probably at that point say, well, you know, we have to do something else. But this is how they don't think things through. And but I do think it's bigger than just having this Pentagon kind of control. That's part of it, but that's only, I think, a smaller part.
So I have a naive question. What is a neocon from? What is their psychology? Where do they hail from? What are their origins? I don't understand what neocons are.
Well, neocons are a mix of things. I mean, some of them, there are elements of the old Cold War. They have the sort of longing to be part of that. They obviously have a very strong view in the Middle East in terms of Israel's security, and they've seen, and they so they view some of these things through that prism. They've made that clear. They feel that there has to be an effort to stop some of the groups that have threatened Israel, and that, you know, so Hezbollah is one of those groups. Who helps Hezbollah? Well, the Iraqis might, maybe the Iranians. So you have to sort of keep going after some of those groups. So you have a mix of things, and you have also this issue of just being very tough. They have a very Cold War mentality of being the most macho people on the block. And that really is very effective in Washington, because as someone said earlier, I think, in one of the earlier presentations, Washington's a place where everyone wants to be the toughest guy, the toughest rhetoric. And that takes on a life of its own. It's because it's not just rhetoric in Washington, because Washington's a place with enormous power. So I think the neocons are kind of a mix of some of those things, but they've become a sort of a definable group in that they favor these very hyper-aggressive approaches to the world. And they push this idea of American exceptionalism, that we don't have to abide by any rules, and that we should just therefore do whatever we want. And regime change is the way it goes. Part of it comes out of the fact that they got tired of negotiations, too. Some of this followed Oslo, where people got tired. Some of the neocons were tired of having negotiations that didn't go anywhere in the Middle East. So let's do regime change instead. So they came up with this idea, and then they put it into play.
Thank you. Recently, the director of the International Red Cross said in an interview what should be obvious, that it's ill-equipped to provide the Red Cross adequate relief after nuclear war. Greg mentioned that even the Humanitarian Weapons Conference sugarcoats the horror. Is there any way to get the public to face the humanitarian consequences, including a massive task of reconstructing both the victorious and vanquished states?
So there's a few things going on here. One is, can the public be engaged on this? And the answer is yes, but it takes a lot of effort. I mean, the public's distracted with lots of other things, and including things that are not at all so serious, and including other serious things, from global warming to what have you. And I think it's important to have events like this, and I'm glad to see that it's being live streamed on the internet so that more people can watch it, because regardless of the fact that the Cold War has ended, and regardless of the fact that the tensions, well, until last year, seemed to have died down between the United States and Russia, the weapons still exist. And people need to hear that, right? The weapons still exist, and as long as these weapons still exist, they demand our attention because they're just that powerful. And so how do we make that happen? It takes a lot of effort. It takes smart media strategy. It takes smart networking, social media, and so on. But it can be done. It just takes effort.
Thanks for that.
That's a hard problem, but maybe just one or two things. That the character of the engagement of the public is reciprocally related to the content that can be assimilated. So the more people are involved and the more committed the types of involvement there are, the types of actions, the types of memberships, the types of life changes, the more challenging the content that can be assimilated positively. And that's certainly been our experience at the study group. We lack infrastructure. There's a tendency for all of us to speak of the public in a kind of amorphous way. We aren't thinking as well as we should about the structure of public involvement, the organization of that involvement, the role of vanguards and small groups which can formulate and carry out leadership. We have a very atomized society, and people feel quite alone and quite frightened and quite overwhelmed by the minutiae of their daily life, let alone any illness or other family crises that may occur. It took me quite a while to realize that the people who are coming through the door of the study group in Santa Fe were, everyone was to one degree or another rather wounded by, and that made them sensitive, and that made them able to appreciate the problems that we had, but it also meant that there needed to be some kind of infrastructure, some kind of structure for helping people work together. And that's why I said in my talk we have to do things. We have to be doctors, not talk about. I'm very glad we're here, and I'm very glad we're doing this, and I have no complaint about that. It's wonderful. But we have to take it when we leave this meeting, we have to take it to the next step.
Thank you. I think the last question is, nuclear risk must be seen in the context of the geopolitical and economic consequences of the capitalist class in the United States in its quest for world domination. And I guess we've heard about that from the neocons. The use of NATO by the US increases the risk exponentially. How can civil society in the US curb the power and destabilizing effects of NATO?
So I don't have a good answer to the specifics of that question. I will say this is a good question. What I like about this question is that it's thinking systemically, right? We have nuclear weapons. We have military forces that are responsible for these nuclear weapons. But there's more going on here than just that. There are political systems, there are economic systems, cultural, social, and so on, all that play a role in what happens with these nuclear weapons. And so if we want to tease out what the best ways to reduce these risks are, I like the spirit of the question, which is to think more broadly about all the different factors going into this, because as we do that, we'll start to see maybe some even creative and unexpected opportunities to reduce the risk. So while I don't have a specific answer to this question, it's not something that I've previously had the chance to look into, I definitely like this holistic thinking that the question brings up.
Anyone else?
Just briefly. I also, for some of the same reasons, I said it at the podium that I didn't think that the United States would have a successful single-issue disarmament movement at this point. However, I do think that the systemic treatment of issues together can be successful because this is it. What is stronger than the political power of the military-industrial complex is the combined political power of everything that the military-industrial complex impoverishes. And that touches many political issues. And we see it in the appropriations committees, which are really the bugaboos of the nuclear weapons complex, because the people that sit on the appropriations committees don't just care about armed forces. They have the Energy and Water Committees. Some of them are there because they have big water concerns in their districts or in their states. They're interested in the water part of energy and water. Well, that's a problem for the weapons labs because those people tend to balance national interests. My God. Well, that is the kind of trade-off that we have to clarify. In Europe, we call it austerity. The problem, we can't have everything. And I think that we have, for a long time, we've assumed that perhaps we can, and perhaps the wealthier class of people in Congress, which has perhaps not experienced very much difficulty in their lives, imagines that it is possible to have everything. But I think the common, ordinary people don't, I think they know better.